Today in Studio 360, as millions of people head to Washington for the inauguration, everybody wants to connect with the new president.
Oh, I didn't hear the beep. Is it recording?
So we asked a few of our favorite artists, actors, writers, saxophone players, to leave some voicemails for Barack Obama.
My great hope for your presidency is that you will find a way to provide accessible health care for artists such as me.
And I'll check in with Dana Gioia, the poet who's been chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Gioia was a Bush appointee, but he's down with a Democratic president who reads poetry.
One wants a president who's engaged with culture as well as business and politics.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That's all ahead today in this inauguration edition of Studio 360, right after this.
Oprah's got your back. Barack, Barack. We know they can't touch that. Barack, Barack. Yes, the things you say are true. Put it together.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. So we are nearly there, just days away from swearing in the 44th President of the United States. It is finally the end of an era, not just the whites-only presidential era or the Bush era, but the two-year-long era of the Obama campaign, his long-shot battle for the nomination, the election, and now the inauguration itself.
3 to 5 million people will swarm the city, crippling Metro and forcing major roadways to shut down.
The Smithsonian may be hosting an employee slumber party of unprecedented proportions.
The big question on everyone's mind.
What is Michelle Obama going to wear to the inauguration?
Rather than speculate about Michelle's ball gown, we asked some of our favorite artists what they wanted from our almost president once he's in office.
To listen to your messages, press 1. First saved message.
Hi, Barack. This is David Harrington with the Kronos Quartet. I hope that over the next 8 years, you continue to remind everyone as often as you can about the value of arts. And I hope that you represent the American people in the best possible way throughout the entire world. Best wishes.
End of message. Next message.
Hi, President-elect Obama. This is Cintra Wilson, critical shopper for the New York Times. I just want to say you are such a stylish man, and I love you almost completely unconditionally. I have a couple of favors to ask. I know you are busy, but if you could see your way around to renouncing the theory of the unitary executive and making the executive office accountable to American law again, that would be so awesome. Just throw away all of the outgoing president's signing statements and all those skeevy presidential and security directives, like with a set of fire tongs, because they left so many cooties all over the Constitution. Oh, and it might be a nice bipartisan gesture to rebuild the Nixon bowling alley. I am just saying, do you feel me? I know you do, because you're my president. All right, baby, have a rockin' good inauguration, Mr. Smokin' Hot Presidentialityness. Mwah! Bye.
End of message. Next message.
Hi, Barack. It's Edwin Torres. How's it going? So listen, I'm a poet in New York City, and I know you love language, too. I mean, your heart and soul are in everything you say, so, you know, that's poetry. I wanted to thank you for bringing a level of awareness to the power of the word, and keep in mind poetry as one of the healing arts of humanity as you go through your term. And maybe write Michelle a love poem when you get a moment.
End of message.
The poet and critic Dana Gioia would probably agree. He is also the outgoing chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, leaving his post now after 6 years. I wanted to get his sense of where the arts in America are headed at this gigantic moment of change and flux. To run the NEA, you've got to be good at making do with what you can get. The annual budget is not even $150 million. That's about 3 or 4 hours of economic stimulus or a day and a half of the war in Iraq. I asked Chairman Gioia what single achievement he was proudest of.
I have to say that the big read is the one I take the greatest pride in because it addresses the most terrifying cultural trend in the United States, which has been a quarter of a century of constant decline in American reading and more lately in reading ability. And we're going to be releasing some numbers that are going to be amazing. The decline in reading has been reversed for the first time in, you know, recorded history.
Really? And what a good time to have some remarkable good news.
It's, you know, it's we need good news on the culture front, and we need especially to believe, and this is proof, that cultural decline is not inevitable.
And is there some kind of new set of challenges that the NEA can now take on?
Well, there's many things that I wish I might have done.
Yeah.
You know, of all these great programs that we did in the NEA over the last 6 years, we did virtually nothing for elementary school. You've got, you know, 40 million kids who have had arts education taken out of their curriculum. That has not merely cultural consequences, but economic consequences. The second thing, and once again, we've made some progress here, but it's just a first step, is cultural diplomacy. The United States cannot speak to the rest of the world merely, you know, through money, politics, and military. There are about 180 nations in the world, and right now, most of them have no cultural exchange with the United States.
Well, and as one looks back at, you know, our great foreign policy success of our lifetimes, which is to say the Cold War, clearly that was part of what we did right in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Absolutely. You know, in retrospect, you know, Eisenhower, who had seen the worst of human behavior in World War II, was the person who said that, you know, we needed what he called soft power. He was the one that created cultural exchange on a broad level for the first time in American history. And in retrospect, that was so smart.
So we have this new president coming in. And I wondered, for instance, when you saw, as I presume you did, the news photo of President-elect Obama carrying a book of poetry by Derek Walcott, how did that feel as a poet?
Well, I think, you know, it's a fine thing when a person in the White House reads poetry. I mean, we've had some great poetry fans in the White House, Abraham Lincoln, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, John Kennedy. You know, one wants a president who's engaged with culture as well as with business and politics.
And what are you expecting from a President Obama culture-wise?
Well, I'm expecting good things, not the least of which because he quoted me in his platform. So, you know, I feel that my vision of what the, you know, federal cultural policy should be in his, you know, aren't far apart. I think we've created a very strong base at the NEA, and I think that there's enormous opportunity to build on it.
And people have said, and people are saying, oh, well, you know, in order to show that this federal government and this president really cares about culture, he should make a cabinet-level culture ministry, if you will, Secretary of Culture. What do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I don't want to, you know, being myself a political figure at the moment, I think it's inappropriate for me to comment on what might be legislative or executive changes. In fact, you know, legally, I've got to be very careful in doing that. I will say this, is that when both the Kennedy and the Johnson administrations began to frame what later became the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, et cetera, they originally looked at a cabinet-level position, and they walked away from it because they felt, I think quite rightly, that it would politicize the job. You know, I do, you know, not think it's an advantage necessarily for the NEA, which is an independent federal agency. I mean, you know, we are able to operate very independently from the political system, to be part of a huge cabinet bureaucracy.
Uh-huh.
I also worry that a culture position at a cabinet level might easily become a Hollywood and video game trade office.
Yeah.
And so I feel without any qualification that the National Endowment for the Arts has an enormous advantage by being independent.
And slightly off the radar and out of the limelight, you're suggesting.
Yeah. And if I have a problem, I can go and talk directly to a senator. I can talk directly to the president. I can talk directly to a member of Congress. If I were part of a cabinet department, I would not be able to do that.
There has been a lot of talk about the inauguration poet, Elizabeth Alexander, who is writing a poem that she'll read on January 20th for this new beginning. I wondered if a poem is in order for the other end of things, for the end of this administration after 8 years.
Well, I would not presume to pick a poem for the president. You know, I think that that would be something that he should pick for himself. But the funny thing is, if you're in Washington right now, you know, all these people are losing their jobs or about to start new jobs, and you realize how Shakespearean Washington is. I mean, you have these great rises to power and these falls. And there's a passage in Shakespeare, Cardinal Wolsey's speech from Henry VI, mm-hmm. Which is so apropos. And I won't read the whole thing, but I'll just read a few lines from it. It goes, "Farewell, a long farewell to all my greatness. This is the state of man. Today he puts forth the tender leaves of hope. Tomorrow blossoms and bears his blushing honors thick upon him. The third day comes a frost, a killing frost, and when he thinks, good, easy man, fully, surely his greatness is a ripening, nips his root, and then he falls as I do. Oh, how wretched is the poor man that hangs on princes' favors! There is betwixt that smile we would aspire to, that sweet aspect of princes and their ruin, more pangs and fears than wars or women have. And when he falls like Lucifer, never to hope again."
That is Dana Gioia reading from Henry VI by Shakespeare. What is it going to be like for you to have your days and nights free to, instead of counting senators and congressmen and courting them, to write poetry again?
It will be a great pleasure to leave political life. You know, I've taken this job very seriously because I think it's so important that the United States have a thriving arts agency. But, you know, I've traveled every week for 7 years, and for 6 years, and I work practically every day of the week. And so it'll be nice to discover my inner life again. And, you know, I'm taking a half-time job at the Aspen Institute to work on their arts programs. And I hope to return and write a few poems.
Well, congratulations and welcome those poems. Dana Gioia, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Later this month, Dana Gioia starts writing that poetry and begins his half-time position directing the program in the arts at the Aspen Institute. Coming up, artists try to set the agenda for Obama's first 100 days.
I'd love to see the Works Project Administration funded by Congress that will help employ millions of people.
That and a lot more recommendations for the new president just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In honor of the inauguration today, we're looking at what Barack Obama's presidency might mean for the arts. Here's Obama himself on Meet the Press last month.
You're going to have a huge impact culturally in terms of the tone of the country.
Right.
Who are the kinds of artists that you would like to bring to the White House?
Oh, well, you know, we have thought about this because part of what we want to do is to open up the White House and remind people this is the people's house. Thinking about the diversity of our culture and inviting jazz musicians and classical musicians and poetry readings in the White House so that once again we appreciate this incredible tapestry that's America. I think is going to be incredibly important, particularly because we're going through hard times.
We've had plenty of artists on this show who would no doubt be encouraged by that vision, but until they get a White House invitation, here are their hopes for the new president.
To listen to your messages, press 1. First saved message sent Friday, January 2nd at 4:48 p.m.
Hey, Barack. Saxophonist Rudresh Mahanthapa here. How are you? Man, it was great to see you the other night at the gig. I'm sorry I didn't get to talk to you. I was kind of mobbed by the crowd there. When I looked up, you were gone. So your predecessor, George, I can't remember his last name, he approved like $500 billion for the military. And I was thinking, if we just took the money that was designated to tanks and any existing tanks that have been built that aren't on the road, that we could strip those down, make hybrid cars out of them, sell those, and take a portion of the profits and channel that towards music education. I think it's going to work great. Plus, we already got a great name for it. We're going to call it Tanks for the Music. What do you say? All right, man. I hope I see you soon. I heard you're bringing jazz back to the White House, so I expect to call very, very soon. Take care, brother. Bye.
Next message sent Saturday, January 3rd at 12:38 p.m.
Hi, Barack. This is Elizabeth Streb. I'm a choreographer in New York City and wanted to weigh in on the easiest, cheapest way to change our world. Here's the plan laid out simply, i.e., every morning before coffee, all 300 million people in the USA would jump up and down three times and do a full 360 turn in the air and finish by snapping into a huge X with their body vertically. This will take a mere 4 seconds total. It's cheap, fast, and no special skills or training are required. If you inaugurate this movement policy, I predict, wars will end, sadnesses will cease, and the need for Ritalin will disappear. Congratulations, and call if you need more information.
Next message sent Sunday, January 4th at 5:13 p.m.
Hey, Barack, it's Wiley Dufresne from WD50 in New York City. I'm a chef here, and congrats on the big win, man. I know you probably have 1,000 things to do right now, but I just wanted to see if you could help me out and make sure that foie gras stays legal while you're in office. Some places, including your hometown, have tried to ban it, and it's really a disturbing trend. Anyway, thanks for hearing me out. Good luck with the move, and hope you can stop by for a bite next time you're in the neighborhood.
End of message. Next message.
Oh, I didn't hear the beep. Is it recording? Okay. Hi, Barack Obama. Congratulations on being our next president. Couldn't happen to a more wonderful person. By the way, this is Lorraine Levine. You know me because of Sarah Jones, the black girl who does the one-person shows. I mean, not that you should know everybody who's black. I know it will be stressful, but try to quit the smoking if you can. And mazel tov.
Excuse me, I'm Lorraine. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But hi, I just wanted to get a moment to say to Mr. President Barack Obama that it is such an honor to be on your voicemail right now. And as a Latina, I'm very excited for your presidency. I mean, I know you don't have any Spanish blood yourself, but you have family from Indonesia, and they all look Latino and everything, so that's kind of close enough for me right now.
Oh, excuse me. I just want to say my piece, you know what I'm saying, was good, Barack Obama. My name is Rashid. Me, I'm not usually an emotional dude, you know what I'm saying, but you know, on January 20th, I feel like I'm probably going to cry in public for the first time since Jay-Z retired. You know what I'm saying? Let's get it popping. The world needs you. Peace.
If you hadn't guessed, those last three characters are really characters played by this woman, Sarah Jones.
Hi, Barack. This is Sarah Jones. Those were some friends of mine, and I thought I would weigh in, too. I'm just hoping that you're going to prioritize quality jobs and education and access to good health care for everybody. And I guess just in general, restoring our place, well, on the world stage. So as a fellow solo performer, that's my little advice as you prepare to open the ultimate one-man show. Break a leg, Barack. Here's hoping for a standing O. Bye.
I can't think of a presidential election in which visual artists played a bigger role, especially that familiar, heroic, high-contrasty red, white, and blue image of Barack Obama, which has become a true icon, thanks to millions of posters and T-shirts and stickers. That image was made by a superstar street artist named Shepard Fairey. We sent WNYC's Siddhartha Mitter to talk to him and some of the other Obama image makers, and they confessed that victory puts them in a tricky situation.
Here is the first painting I did of Barack. Sorry, watch your step. It's really messy.
In the workspace of his apartment in Chinatown,
David Cho points to some of the portraits he's done of Barack Obama in the past year.
I noticed that his hairline from a side profile sort of looks like the United States, so I drew the United States on his hairline. That is
the image appeared on posters and T-shirts and bus shelter ads around the country during the campaign.
This was more of a sketch.
Cho is 32, a Los Angeles transplant to New York, who mainly works with pop culture themes like robots and comics and Asian kitsch.
I'm not that political at all, so this is sort of a out of character thing for me to do.
Until the saturation of all things Obama around him finally forced him to pay attention. And, like many others, catch himself actually relating to the non-white outsider candidate.
Here comes this guy who overcame these like crazy odds. When you can connect with someone, I'm like, whoa.
But when he attended the festivities around the Democratic National Convention in Denver last August, he found himself a bit bemused by the whole thing.
I'd never seen such an outpouring from the artist community of painting the same, almost exactly the same thing. And where else do you see this? Jesus, the Virgin Mary.
On one level, it seems like it's Beatlemania.
That's Ron English. His image for the campaign was called Abraham Obama. It's the one that merges the silhouettes of Lincoln and Obama against multicolored backgrounds. He put it up on huge posters on city walls around the country. Now the election is over. His guy won. And in his studio, English has been working out his feelings on a new canvas.
This is Frankenstein, which actually I kind of painted after going on this huge Obama tour, and I was starting to think, you know, like every artist I knew was out doing Obama stuff and supporting Obama, and it's like we kind of made him into a historical figure before he even, you know, had a chance to make history. And I started thinking maybe we've, like, created a monster. I don't know.
English is worried that artists like himself have only added to the huge expectations of Obama.
A lot of people have kind of accused us of, you've blown this guy into something that he isn't.
One person who's already had to check his expectations is one of Obama's best-known supporters in the art world.
Well, Obama has already done something that I was disappointed in.
No artist is more closely identified with the Obama campaign than Shepard Fairey. His red and blue Obama stencil became the icon. It's the one you've seen over and over on posters and merchandise and mimicked in all kinds of clever ways. Fairey is among those Obama supporters who are upset with the choice of Pastor Rick Warren to deliver the invocation at the inauguration.
And I was vocal about my disappointment. I'm going to call him out if he does anything, but with the qualification that it's not an overall withdrawal of my support, it's just I'm speaking my mind.
And he plans to continue. Fairey wants to stay engaged in the political process. But whatever happens with his political activities, Fairey's original Obama portrait now has a permanent home in a temple of establishment culture, the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it's a coup. It's an ironic coup.
Ironic because Fairey got his start making street art in the tradition of the graffiti artists of the 70s. So did Ron English.
For, you know, the last 30 years, I've done illegal billboards, and I did not want to do anything illegal for Obama. So every wall that I worked on that I did, we called in advance, we got permission, and which was actually quite difficult for somebody like me who's used to just doing what you're going
to
do.
But maybe it's time to get comfortable with a new role, says English.
You can't be an outlaw your whole life. At some point, you know, hopefully you change the society to the point where you're not an outlaw and you're part of society.
And there are benefits to be reaped as well, like a livelihood. For some less-known artists, doing Obama pieces has given them a platform to promote their other work. Sculptor Michael Murphy.
I was just kind of hoping that my images would get picked up like Shepard Fairey's did.
Murphy has made three-dimensional Obama portraits that use wires and nails to cast shadows at specific angles.
So I got online and started a membership on every website I could find that had anything to do with Obama art and started pushing my work out there.
The images he circulated have gotten more people interested in Murphy's work than he could ever have hoped for, sitting in Millersville, Georgia, far from the major art centers.
The popularity of the art has definitely led to some name recognition for a lot of these artists, like Michael
Murphy. The last 7 months, Ken Harmon has kept track of the scene on a website he calls the Obama Art Report. He's watched the volume of work grow and resale prices go up and down with the fortunes of the campaign, mainly up, with first-run Shepard Fairey prints going for up to $7,000 on eBay.
However, at the same exact time, you have a lot of street artists who have remained completely anonymous and who refuse to accept any recognition whatsoever and rejected any sort of fame.
David Cho has no plans to stay involved now that the election is won.
I'm really proud and happy about the work, but on one end, it's like, I just want to do graffiti, you know?
Mainly, Cho is just impressed that outsider artists could play any role in supporting a winning presidential candidate.
When guys that are, like, known felons for painting on freeway signs upside down and saying, yeah, that's our man, is that helping him? In the end, it was yes.
As for actually voting, Cho didn't bother. He's already washed his hands of whatever happens next.
For Studio 360, I'm Siddhartha Mitter.
You can see some of those images of Obama at studio360.org.
To listen to your messages, press 1.
Hi, my name is DJ Rekha. I'm a New York-based DJ in Bhangra music and South Asian cultural production. Congratulations, Mr. President, on your great victory. I voted for you, along with the rest of Brooklyn. My great hope for your presidency is that you will find a way to provide accessible health care for artists such as me. Thank you again, and congratulations.
Next message sent Monday, January 5th at 3:34 p.m. Urgent message.
Hey, Barack, it's Mike Daisy. Listen, I know it's tempting to let bygones be bygones, but if you don't call for a direct investigation of the Bush administration's activities in sanctioning torture and rewriting the rule of law, you're part of the problem. Man up. You have majorities in both houses. I mean, if not now, never. Do the right thing. Thanks.
Next message sent Monday, January 5th at 4:17 p.m.
Hey, Barack. It's Iris Barr, actor, writer. I hope I'm not calling at a bad time. I'm not sure if you're a napper. Anyway, besides the run-of-the-mill requests for saving the economy, better public education, gun control, some sort of solution in the Middle East, I was hoping you could require all 18-year-olds to do 1 year of civil service. On a more important note, I'm also asking that you outlaw fast food chains. It's the only way to get the American people eating better, by force. I mean, we can't all be naturally lean like you, Barack. Okay, that came out wrong. I didn't mean to be disrespectful. I know you work hard for that physique. And, all right, who says the word physique anymore? And I feel like a total idiot. I'm going to go. Call me later or text me. You're not going to call or text. All right, I love. No, love is not the right word. Thank you, and good luck, and thank you for listening. Say hi to the kids. Bye.
In Iris Barr's one-woman stage show, she runs through an amazing cast of characters, each of whom she writes and performs. One of them is Svetlana, a Russian prostitute who moonlights for us sometimes as a cultural commentator. And Svetlana has her own ideas about this historic moment.
It has been hectic time at St. Petersburg House of Discreet Pleasure. Georgie has been going through postpartum depression of sorts. Oh, Svetlana, what do I do now? I'm under overqualified for everything. I like baseball, but I don't even know PowerPoint. I said, Bushy, forget that stuff. Now's your chance for some fun, like doing cameo on CSI Miami or hopping on the wrestling circuit. I mean, the options are endless. Speaking of which, I just saw Darren Aronofsky's new film, The Wrestler, with Mickey Rourke. Now, I usually pack a bundle of razor blades when I go to Darren's films because I know they're as uplifting as foosball in Gulag, but this time he really took the cake. Every scene, every location was the most depressing possible. Even when Mickey goes to make collect calls, the payphone is on some deserted post-apocalyptic trash-ridden street. I mean, you could almost smell the dead bodies and destitution rising from the pavement, as if Mickey could not find better payphone in some mini mall or something. Why is it that you can only find two kinds of American movies? Cheesy schlock with Jennifer Aniston and some puppy? Or wrist cutter like The Wrestler or that other ball of sunshine, Synecdoche, which felt like 2 hours of Kaufman shoving grape nuts down my throat. Without milk. Without milk. At least with depressing European films, there are sex scenes. Oh, we are depressed French people, but we are drinking cognac and copulating in the meantime. In American film, you don't even get that because the main guy is too jacked up on OxyContin to have libido. It's like there is no middle ground in this country. It's either Disney or depressing, Uberman or impotent. Bush is disaster, Obama is going to be salvation from our disaster. Come on. Yes, Bushy was Bats, but now you give this new guy bumper stickers with his face on them? It's scary. Look, I know Barack. He has been client for many years. And let me tell you something. He's just skinny guy with good smile and insecurities like every other man in the bedroom. He is by far my skinniest client, by the way. I call him Barack the Buttless Wonder. I have to be honest. Makes me a little nervous having skinny president. My mother always told me skinny people are spawns of Satan. She was plump woman, as you can imagine. Yes, of course it's better to look at handsome men for president rather than donut. Of course, hope and change is good thing. But life is not either happy ending or horrible tragedy. It's usually in the middle, like sex with spouse. It's not disaster, it's not salvation, it's okay. Like Viagra Light. I have to tell you, I have been living in America for 15 years, and I have never understood how such big place with so many different people can feel like one country. I mean, I don't talk to my Chinese neighbors, and the Armenian guy upstairs cooks food that makes the hallway smell like human foot. With dictator, it's much easier. He tells you, you have one thing in common, me. What I say goes. That way the whole country is of one mind, because we have no choice. But here, so many people, so many choices, they feel lost. The only thing that unites them is their Disney dream, which is why when that dream is shattered, they are suddenly in Requiem for a Dream. I give Bami credit for offering unifying message. But let's not forget, it's just a message, and he's just a guy. Like I tell my clients that say to me, Svetlana, you're a goddess. I tell them, never give anyone or anything too much power or meaning. Even the good guy with a good message. It's too dangerous. We do not need the Messiah to save us because we do not need saving. We are okay in this country, trust me. We just need good guy with shoulder to lean on during the tough times. I have to tell you, Bami's shoulders are a little bony for my taste, but they will be just fine. Okay, I have to go. Rick Warren invited me over for some potato pancakes and Pictionary. I told him I am bringing friend that works at Planned Parenthood. He almost had heart attack. This is Svetlana Maksimovskaya for Studio 360. Bye-bye.
Svetlana, a character created and incarnated by Iris Barr. Iris Barr's one-woman show about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Die, the Hebrew word for enough, is playing in Washington, D.C. this weekend and in L.A. for a few weeks, starting at the end of the month. Closing out our series of voicemails for Barack Obama, sculptor Richard Serra.
Hi, this is Richard Serra. I'd like to congratulate you, Mr. President. I think what the country needs in terms of a cultural policy is one that both starts from the bottom up and the top down. By that I mean that artists need to go into local communities and interactively work with the urban children at a very early age, right up through the entrance into college. On the other hand, I think you have to start from the top down, and that means that what we need is a cultural minister. It could even be on a cabinet level. So that means the appointment has to be thought through very quickly. Thank you very much. Bye.
End of messages. Are you still there?
I think that our art and our culture, our science, that's the essence of what makes America special, and we want to project that as much as possible in the White House.
Our voicemails were produced by Studio 360's Sarah Lilly. And you can tell us what you think President Obama ought to do for the culture at studio360.org. The program for the inauguration reads like some kind of dream team of American musicians. Yitzhak Perlman, Aretha Franklin, John Williams, and one of Barack Obama's all-time favorites, Yo-Yo Ma. When Yo-Yo Ma visited Studio 360 about a year ago, he played a piece for us that is apparently on Obama's iPod, Bach Suites for Cello. This piece is also one of Yo-Yo Ma's favorites. He plays it every day as a warm-up exercise and a kind of meditation.
I think of the flow of water, of, you know, the light, afternoon light playing in the on the leaves, so that you see something that is familiar, and yet it's different every day.
Is it really? I mean, you must have played that piece of music hundreds and hundreds of times in your life.
Yeah,
thousands, maybe.
But what's amazing is that, you know, I could, with a great friend, you could see them thousands of times, and you don't look at them and say, well, today I'm really bored with you.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. But I learned it playing this way. As a four-year-old. And, you know, until sometime around I was a teenager, I thought, you know, I look at the score and it's written different bowing, so I tried that. And then at some point I was asked by the head of the Schweitzer Institute. He wanted me to talk about Bach. And so suddenly, having to verbalize music that I had known forever took me to another way of thinking about sort of, well, Bach, Schweitzer described, was a pictorial composer. And then I thought about, well, what does that mean? So one of the things that he coded was infinite variety. Instead of the materiality of saying, this is the same thing, I need a new product, it's something new every time. This is a minuet.
That's Yo-Yo Ma playing Bach. If you're lucky enough to be at the inauguration in Washington next Tuesday, you can hear Yo-Yo Ma play live as part of a special superstar quartet of American musicians. And you can hear some more of our conversation, if you'd like, at studio360.org.
It's kind of scary. Because look, if you fall, you can hurt yourself a lot. Because there might be pointy things.
Coming up, how do you fit all of New York City into one room?
The teeny little building.
It looks so small.
I know. It's because in real life, those so if those were an inch tall, in real life, it would be 100 feet tall.
Wow.
We'll explain. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC.
It might be a park, because I see a park right there with a river.
Yeah, I think it's a park.
Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Everyone is coming to the New York World's Fair. They're coming from the four corners of the earth. And from Five Corners, Idaho. They come down from New Athens, Maine.
Before the World Wide Web, there were the World's Fairs. Hugely ambitious, vast in scope, World's Fairs were the global marketplace of ideas and culture and industry. They were showcases of design that offered peeks into these fantastic futures. I remember as a kid reading about the 1964 World's Fair in New York. I was dying to get there, but I only made it as far as Chicago. At the Museum of Science and Industry there, I said hi to a stranger on the other end of the line of a video phone at the Real World's Fair in Flushing Meadows, Queens. Stephen Talasnik is about the same age as me, and he, the lucky dog, he got to visit. His family drove up from Philadelphia.
There is the symbol of the fair, the great Unisphere.
I am looking at an object that I first saw when I was 9 years old. And when I see this, I'm clearly reminded of the day we came to the fair. I'm clearly reminded of even some of the things that we ate as children when we came to the fair.
In his subsequent career as an artist, Stephen Talasnik has never forgotten that moment of wonder. He has an installation of drawings on view right now at the Queens Museum on the site of the old fairgrounds. His work is incredibly detailed and entirely done in pencil. There are these big helter-skelter blueprints and sketches of floating arches and spiral domes. It's a dream of visionary architecture reminiscent of the 12-story high steel Unisphere, which is still standing.
I had the endearing opportunity to bring my 5-year-old son here. And his response was just what I was hoping for. He was overwhelmed, as a 5-year-old would be, to see this huge ball that was a globe with rings around it.
Which probably at this point most of the world knows if they know it from Men in Black.
Exactly.
The movie.
he was awestruck by it. I'm hoping that it doesn't damage him, but the idea is that this is an image that has potential to stay with someone over a lifetime.
It could damage him if by damage you mean turning him into an artist, I guess.
It could. That would be a severe. That would be a serious damage.
Now, seeing that jet landing right behind it, it couldn't be better.
It couldn't be better. What context? You could stand here all day and watch the planes take off.
Well, it makes you feel as though you're in the jet age.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's definitely 64-ish.
Yeah.
It's the illusion of technology, but it certainly isn't accurate in terms of its depiction of a lot of things.
But again, like so much of your work, it's if the Earth had a steel superstructure, there it is.
That's what it would look like.
But to my mind, the real enduring gem of the 64 World's Fair is inside the Queen's Museum, the panorama of the city of New York. This panorama is an astonishing 3D scale model of the entire metropolis, all five boroughs, all the buildings at a scale of 1 inch to 100 feet, which means the Empire State Building tops out at 15 inches high. 895,000 buildings and bridges, each one handcrafted. There are even little airplanes strung on wires above it, taking off from New York's airports. It is easy to see the attraction for a 9-year-old boy. Now, 45 years later, Stephen Tlaznik has hung his drawings all around the rim of the quarter-acre model. The exhibition is called Panorama, the Mapping of Prediction.
I came into the panorama room, which I had not been in since 1964. And as I was walking around with the then curator, we would listen to group after group of schoolchildren come in, and it would get loud with a tremendous enthusiasm that was expressed by the kids. Enthusiasm would be polite.
It's right there. See the X?
I think there's a school right there where the light is. My grandmother lives in Queens, and she...
The beauty of coming in this entrance is that you're supposed to recreate what it's like to be in a helicopter, looking down at the city. This is quite rare. Things like this do not exist anymore unless they're digitally created.
Right.
And then you're looking on a screen.
The shock and awe.
Exactly.
And the tactility isn't there.
Well, tactility, I think, is a huge part of the success of the piece.
Now, what's that? I mean, that's Prospect Park, obviously. But
yeah.
What's the...
There's a cemetery.
Oh, that's Greenwood Cemetery.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I had no idea it was that huge. What's interesting is, of course, all these docks with big ships moored at them, piers along the lower west side of Manhattan, which haven't been there for the 32 years I've lived in New York.
Right.
Yet, there are the World Trade Towers, ironically, which obviously were stuck in at some moment after this thing was originally built and haven't been taken away.
Who would like to raise your hand and share with me what you recognize in lower Manhattan?
The Twin Towers!
Okay.
The Twin
Towers.
I like seeing the Twin Towers because I never got to see them. I feel it's amazing because they don't exist anymore.
There is this sense of a past, a present, and a future that really comes out of this static little collection of plywood buildings.
Now, your work is here along the rim as we go around. Let's talk about this big one here, which is 8 feet long? And
Ten feet long, and it's divided into 10 panels. It's about 16 inches high, and it is all pencil. So what you're looking at is the skeletal part of a variety of different types of structures, whether it is similar to the roller coaster, towers, roadways, expressways. And the subject matter has always been the city, the metropolis.
How did you avoid becoming an architect?
Interestingly enough, I feel like a born-again architect, but I really was not very good as a math student. I was a regular reader of a magazine called Popular Mechanics that would regularly show architectural drawings of houses, and I used to look at these blueprints as if they were some type of photograph or drawing. And the fact that I didn't become an architect, I think, is probably a good thing.
And sometimes, if you take a section like this section, it threatens to look like a Kandinsky or some entirely abstract piece. And then you come over here, and there are gears and Escher-like stairs.
The idea is to try to invent and to keep it fictional, but somehow believable there is enough that is familiar to make you want to spend the time involving yourself with it.
Because look, if you fall, you can hurt yourself a lot. Because there might be pointy things on top of you.
It's rare that I have the opportunity to show the work to a real cross-section of people and ages. And probably more children have seen this show than have ever seen any of my other shows.
Awesome!
And I think that's really important.
Look, we're standing on top of the part that I was talking about.
If this thing breaks, then we're going to fall.
Stephen Tlasnik's exhibition at the Queen's Museum of Art closes later this month. You can see pictures of his work and of our trip to the panorama of New York at studio360.org.
It's 2 blocks south at the ending of the Queen's World Bridge.
How many buildings do you think there are down there?
I don't know, more than 100, I'd say.
My trip out to see the Unisphere and the Old World's Fairgrounds got me thinking about another classic of 20th century American design. Used to be almost every town in the United States had a railroad car diner. Some were actual railroad dining cars repurposed, others really just one-room restaurants. Before fast food chains, the diner was ubiquitous. Today in Design for the Real World, curator Richard J.S. Gutman explains why an American classic from the aluminum age never really goes out of style.
What'll it be, gents?
Spaghetti and coffee for two.
All right, sir.
When someone mentions the word diner, the image that pops into my mind is a long, low building with an unbroken band of windows. Maybe it's clad in stainless steel or porcelain enamel. Might have a big sign on top that shouts out the word diner, but it doesn't even need one. One of the things that does identify the diner on the inside is that it has counter service, and frequently all the food was made behind the counter, so you would see a flourish of activity with the counter man juggling orders,
pass me a pancake man, drink,
flipping pancakes,
having a derby, derby,
frying eggs, shoving home fries around the counter. The diner began right here in Providence in 1872 as a horse-drawn lunch wagon that came out after other restaurants had closed for the evening, and that was just a converted freight wagon, but they were elaborately painted almost like a circus wagon. They had colored glass windows, and of course the inside had the gigantic nickel-plated coffee urn, a little grill, and a small counter that the proprietor served the food over. One of the reasons why the diner looked the way it did was that being built in the factory, it needed to be transported to its site. It had to be narrow in order to navigate the streets. So the diner evolved into this vehicle-like building that looked like it was moving itself, hence that railroad look. The equipment in a diner is all compact. It's all designed to fit into a very streamlined, efficient form so that you have pieces of equipment like a toast mistress, which is a three-slice toaster, industrial strength, that would be able to do the exact number of slices for a club sandwich.
Hey, you're Florence. Could I have some French fries with gravy, please?
Stainless steel first came into diners in the 1930s when a coffee equipment fabricator went to install some urns in a diner, and legend has it he thought, it wouldn't be a bad idea to cover up some of this wooden trim with stainless steel because then you could keep it looking nice without revarnishing. You just polish it up a little bit.
I've got grease and dirt, but I can get rid of grease and dirt. I spray and wipe.
The fact that it's operating on a 24-hour basis, it's a place where you can go in and get some sustenance in the middle of the night, it bespeaks of the kind of comfort that you can get from a place that is always there for you.
Well, always got the diner.
Yeah, we always got the diner.
Barry Levinson's film Diner portrayed the diner as the hangout for people who were coming of age in the 1950s. They went there all the time. They discussed their problems, their girlfriends. And I think it was a perfect vehicle, if you pardon the pun, to sum up that time period. I think everything must change with the times. And if the diner is inserted into an airport, for example, you're still serving that diner food. You could take it away and eat out on the curb like you could on a lunch wagon, or take it onto your airplane and make the passenger sitting next to you jealous.
Richard J.S. Gutman is the author of American Diner, Then and Now. He's a curator at the Culinary Arts Museum. Catherine Ident produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson, and that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. If you'd like to subscribe to the free weekly podcast of Studio 360, you can do so at studio360.org, where you can also subscribe to our behind-the-scenes newsletter. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein, Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Rob Weisberg,
Catherine Epstein,
Kurt Schlachter,
Josie Holtzman,
Nick Haling.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegen.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
In the new movie Defiance, Liev Schreiber plays a gun-toting World War II hero.
We will send for everyone who is left alive.
And when the Germans follow, what then?
I will bring them out myself.
But even big, manly movie stars were little kids once. Were you actually nicknamed Huggy?
Yes, I was. I still am called Huggy around my brothers and my mother, which is pretty humiliating.
Liev Schreiber, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.